It's Sunday morning. Time for the Great Outdoors with Charlie Potter. Brought to you by the all-new Chevy Silverado and ChevyDriveChicago.com on Chicago's very own 720 WGN.
Good morning. Welcome to the Great Outdoors Show. Charlie Potter, your host here on WGN Radio, as we roll through what is turning into an increasingly wet middle part of summer. Certainly, it's gotten the attention of people who have food plots along the Illinois and Missouri rivers again, and along the Mississippi, as we are entering a time of the year when, if the rivers come out of their banks, there's no replanting that's possible. And we, once again, after having what looked like what was absolutely ideal conditions for planting of food plots and wildlife habitat in the riparian quarters of America, the heartland of America, we now are very wet, and certainly you've seen some of the flooding that's taking place along the Ohio. So we've had several years in a row where we've had subpar wildlife habitat along the major riparian corridors of the Midwest because of very high waters in the spring. Farmers couldn't get in and plant. A lot of natural foods were flooded out. This year, everything was setting up to be perfect. But if we continue to have the kind of rains that we're getting right now and have had over the past 10 days, we're going to see once again a big diminution of the amount of food available for not only deer and turkey, but waterfowl as well in some of the key areas of the Midwest. Let's hope that doesn't happen, but the watch is definitely up on that. This morning, I want to start off with, I guess, a story that hopefully you'll enjoy, and maybe it'll make you think of some event in your life that took place. And that is something that happened to me last week with my son. My son has now reached the age where he is going to head to college here in a few weeks. A sad time for me, as it's probably been for all of you who saw your sons or daughters go off to college. So my son and I decided to do something that we've done since he was a little boy, and that is to go fishing. And we happened to be out west in the mountains of Idaho on what would be our last time to go fishing together before he went off to college. And who knows when my next time to fish with him will be. And it made me think back in a very happy but also sad way of where he caught his first fish when he was 2 years old and where we sit side by side in streams when he was a little boy. And I held on to the back of his belt so he didn't fall into the river, and the thrill of him catching his first trout, and then the thrill of him catching his first northern, and the thrill of him catching his first salmon and his first bass, and kind of that timeline we all have as parents, if we really step back to think about it, as we watch our kids grow up. And my timeline, as I'm sure is true of many of yours, has been with my kids, has been in the outdoors. And that's one of the things I love about the Great Outdoors Show, is it enables not only me to connect with so many of you who have outdoor experiences, but also enables us to talk about the things that in so many ways enrich our lives, which is taking our kids or our grandkids or just friends into the outdoors. And so as I was heading over a mountain pass last week with my son, that's 18 years old, he's fully grown, and I was thinking about, you know, when he was two and when he was four and the things we did. And so we went over the pass into a fairly remote area of the high mountains of Sawtooth in Idaho. And we were headed to a stream where he and I, probably 10 years ago, had one of those days of fishing that a little boy and his dad will never forget. We stood shoulder to shoulder in the river, and we were fortunate to catch a number of cutthroat trout and cross cutbows, they call them, cross between rainbows and cutthroat trout in this high mountain stream. And so we were headed back to this river as kind of to close the loop between when we started at age six fishing there and to now age 18, he's going off to college. And I think both of us in our, both of us in our minds were thinking this is, in a way, this is the last hurrah, and who knows when we'll have another one. Because life tends to go faster and faster, and as we all know, it's hard to get the time with kids, much less grab the time with young adults. And so it was our kind of our send-off together, and so we reached the stream, and as an area we actually had never fished an area that Truby had never fished in. It was a hot, clear day, and so we started to fish fly fishing, and there were a few small fish rising, but nothing much, and we moved about half a mile downstream to an area where there were boulders, and it was hot in the day, and I think my son was feeling the effects of having had maybe a couple late nights out with his friends before they all went to college, and so he was maybe not as attentive as he might have been, and I was fishing, and all of a sudden, this cutbow, combination cutthroat at rainbow, and I was fishing with a big size 14 stimulator dry fly with a dropper below it, and it was more about being there than it was about actually catching the fish. And I was talking to my son, who was sitting on the bank, having lost some of his enthusiasm after fishing for a while and thus not catching anything, and all of a sudden I saw this movement in the water, and this shadow came up, and cut bows are not like mini trout or other fish. They don't come up aggressively in a flash and take it. They have a slower, more methodical way, and they come up and they rise to the fly, and they kind of roll with it, and then they go. And this was like the monster of monsters. And here it came up from behind this boulder, and I saw it coming at the last moment towards the fly, and I watched it open its mouth, turn its head sort of sideways, and take the fly. And the next thing I knew, there was a 4-weight fly rod. The next thing I knew, the rod was just absolutely bent double, and the weight of this fish was going with the current and pulling all the line with it and into my backing. And it was singularly the largest cutbow or cutthroat trout I had ever had on. And there I was sitting there with my son, and his eyes were as big as mine, as if we were way overmatched. The rod was nowhere near enough, big enough for the fish, and the line was a 5X fly line, so very light fly line, only a 3.5-pound test, and I probably had, I had way over 3 pounds of fish on it, plus a current. And we knew we were in for quite the battle, and so after fighting the fish for a while, I gave the rod to my son because we did not have a net. The only way we were going to land this fish was for me to get down below it where I could somehow get a hold of it and then release it back into the river. So we couldn't get the fish. While we got it within 6 or 8 feet of it several times, we could not get this large trout to a place where I could really touch it and release the fly. And it was singularly, as I said, the largest fish, the cutthroat I've ever had on the line. And anyway, we're fighting this fish, and my son is doing everything he can to get it over towards the bank. And I gently put my hand on the leader and worked my way down towards the fish, towards the fly, to try to be able to release it. And I got within about 3 feet, and the fish sort of saw this hand coming towards it and shook its head in a great surge. And even though I was barely touching the fly line, that was all it took. And boom, the fly snapped. The line snapped, and off went the fish into the current again. And I stood there, and I looked at my son, Trey, and it was, both of us had that feeling of, oh, my goodness, we have just lost the biggest trout we're likely ever to catch, cutthroat. And it was after about a 15-minute fight with the fish, and it was moving it around rocks, and it was running the show the entire way. And we stood there and just marveled at what we had just done. And so we retied the fly, and we had a few minutes more fishing before we had to go back to town. And I was casting around the rocks, and Trey was casting as well. And I hooked another rainbow cutbow. And I said to Trey, why don't you take this? It's the last fish of the day. You take the rod. And before I could hand him the rod, and I said, it's not a very big fish. Before I handed him the rod, this fish did something that only the biggest of fish can do. It started upstream, and it started to take line, and it took more line. The next thing I knew, I had 30 or 40 yards of fly line going up current. This was a fish that was even larger than the fish we had just lost. The two largest cutthroat trout I have ever had on my line, back-to-back, in a pool that was maybe separated by 50 feet, after all the years I've been fishing, And this fish, I handed the rod to my son, and this time we had a 6-weight rod because I had not retied the line with a 4-weight, so we had a bigger rod. We had the same test weight line, but we had a bigger rod, and with the blue sky overhead and the sun beating down on us in the high desert, the battle was on. And we had a cutthroat that 25 inches with 26 inches might not be too big to say how big it was. And we fought it, and we fought it, and again, we couldn't get it near the bank. I didn't have a net. My son Trey, using all of his skills, and it made me think of when he was 5 or 6 years old, and he caught a 6 or 8 inch trout, and how it took everything he had to hold that fish on his line. And now here he was, 18 years old, with a cutthroat that was probably going 4 pounds, 3.5 or 4 pounds, 25, 26 inches long, and it was taking everything he had, everything he had learned, and how to fight a fish. And we tried to bring it to the bank. We couldn't. We got close to it a couple times, and maybe 3 or 4 feet, and I would reach out to try to grab it by the tail, and the fish would race off into the current again. And then, as happens after you fought a fish for a while, it was out in the current. My son was trying to move it towards the shore, and suddenly, poof, the line goes slack. The fish had spit out the fly, and that was it. Watching a rod that spent more than double, and watching the muscles on my son's forearms as he fought this fish, and all of a sudden, in just the blink of less than the blink of an eye, the rod goes limp, sits straight up in the air, and you look and you realize that this is what it's all about. It's not about the catching of the fish. It's not about the handling of the fish. It's about the fun of the hunt, the fun of finding the fish, getting them to take the fly that you presented, having the fight. And if you bring them in and you release the fly, that's great. But if you don't, in many ways, that's part of the mystery. We'll never know exactly how big this fish was, but what I'll know is that I watched, in a way, the full circle from the time my son was 2, when he caught his first bluegill in a farm pond here in Illinois. All the years and all the places and everywhere we've been, to now where he goes off to college, 18, to lose a fish the size of the fish that we just lost, to have those experiences. It just kind of came in sort of a flash to me, all of these things that I've done all these years. And I tell this morning because I think so many of us have been in the same place. We've watched our kids or our grandkids grow up, and we've done all the things we can with them to try to shape them into the kinds of people we'd like them to be. And in so many of our cases, it revolves around the outdoors. It revolves around fishing or hunting or hiking or just doing things or boating. And then it's over. Then they're on their way in life. And so it, to me, was a really happy moment to watch this fish just go off back into the stream, never having touched it. And also it was that sort of moment realizing it's gone too, my 18-year-old son. Off to college, as so many of you have sent your sons and daughters off to college. So that's kind of my outdoors experience as I think about it. And if you have a young child in your family, or if you have a grandchild, or you have a friend who's got a young child, it's the memories we create with our kids and our grandkids and young kids that makes, in a way, the outdoor experiences that we enjoy so much more valuable. And those are the memories and the stories that last us a lifetime. When I come back, I'll have more on the Great Outdoors Show, and I'm going to talk a little bit about sand in Lake Michigan. And if we have time, I'm going to talk about forests and forest fires. This is Charlie Potter on the Outdoor Voice of Chicago and America, 720 WGN, and first a message from Northwest Indiana and Chicagoland Chevrolet dealers.
Winter is here, and it's always tough on the road. But when the going gets tough, the tough get going. And nothing is tougher than the 2016 Chevy Silverado. Silverado is the longest-lasting, most dependable pickup on the road. With all-steel construction, Silverado is built to tame Chicago's winter weather. And Silverado's towing package offers 11,400 pounds of towing capacity. Perfect for hauling your snowmobiles. I love pulling my neighbors out of their snowdrifts. And right now, you can get $7,250 total savings on a 2016 Chevy Silverado All-Star, $7,250. That really warms my heart. Go to ChevyDriveChicago.com and get all the details. Or head to your Chicagoland and Northwest Indiana Chevy dealer today and pick up a pickup that works as hard as you do, on the road or off. Chevy Silverado is one tough customer.
It's Charlie Potter and the Great Outdoors on Chicago's very own 720 WGN.
Welcome back to the Great Outdoors Show. Charlie Potter, your host here on WGN Radio. And let me shift from memories with our children in the outdoors to something that was in the paper this week, which is a subject for actually another time, because it's a long subject. But I'm going to just touch on it this morning because it's really important, I think, to the future of Lake Michigan and the Great Lakes. And that is, there was an article this week about sand, the shifting sands of Lake Michigan, and how the Indiana Dunes were built, and how we have, over time, totally changed the dynamics of the lake currents and the shifting of the sands with all of the breakwaters and landfill and everything that's been done over the past 100-plus years. The point of this is Lake Michigan and all the Great Lakes are dynamic. And when we think about, and they're always changing, and when we think about Indiana Dunes State Park, that was something that was built over thousands of years of winds and currents and waves and the sands coming down all the way from Lake Superior, all the way down Lake Michigan, and ultimately hitting the southern shore. It created these massive dunes that we have in southern Indiana and over into southeast Michigan. And those sands came down the west side of the lake and where Waukegan is in Chicago. And it's a constant circular motion that goes on. And yet now we're beginning to wonder, some areas have sand build up and they have to dredge their harbors every year, and other areas are starved for sand and they're having terrible erosion problems. What we've done is we've changed the way the lake operated through all of our actions of, as I said, break walls and landfills. One of the ideas out there, which I think is one that's really worth pursuing, and it's one that Bill Cullerton, who was the host of the show for many years before me, was a huge advocate of, and that is building reefs off the shoreline of Lake Michigan. Underwater reefs, Bill's idea was they would be great for fishing, but they're also, people are now understanding, they can be very helpful in managing soil erosion, managing the sand. So it's the entire, there's nothing natural anymore about Lake Michigan, particularly the southern part of Lake Michigan. We've changed all this. So it's pure folly for us to sit here and think that we shouldn't touch the lake because it's in its natural state. What we should look at is, how do we improve upon the lake using our best skills and the best technology we have, so that we have a really vibrant ecosystem, not only for fish, but for water quality and obviously for usage. And this notion that we can create, which is true, underwater reefs, or in fact a series of barrier islands, is really worthy of consideration, not only for the long-term vibrancy of the lake, but also for the lake's ability to be a great recreational resource. And so that discussion is beginning. There's a commission that's been formed involving numerous municipalities, multi-states. It's a big idea, but can Lake Michigan in some way be managed in a better way than it is today, not only for the shifting of sand so that everyone benefits, but also for the future of recreation? I'm going to have to leave it there, but I plant that seed this morning, and it's a big idea that if it takes hold, could make, for the next 100 years, Lake Michigan even a better place. Thanks so much for listening. This is Charlie Potter on the Outdoor Voice of Chicago and America, 720 WGN.